And welcome back to our fifth and final episode of Distracted Propaganda of our pilot season. We are your hosts. I am Alan.
And I'm Lucas.
And today we'll be talking about globalization. We have a couple of things that we kind of went into, especially talking about the effects it has nationally here in the United States, as well as elsewhere in developing nations. I know Lucas talks a bit about Malta, and we delve into that. We also talk about how things are kind of just looking the same, and whenever we go places, what are we really going for? Is it an experience or just a change in scenery? Because just how much of it is the same. We also wanted to apologize for posting so late, especially to our one avid loyal listener. Please do not stop listening to us. You could definitely blame Lucas, though.
It is actually my fault, though. What happened was, I'm a teacher, and this was the last week of school. All grades were due. I thought I would have more time. That did not happen, so we just had to kind of delay it. But the good news moving forward is that Alan and I have decided that this is something we want to commit to, and we're actually going to do seasons of Distracted Propaganda from here on out. And so we're actually going to have an off season during the summer from here on out where we can record, and then we'll have an official season during the fall and winter. But we'll explain more about that in our outro.
Yeah, when we close this episode and this initial season out, we'll go more into what our plans are, what our intentions are, and we would love to hear from you guys. Again, we do have an email, destructivepropaganda@gmail.com, but to be honest with you, I haven't checked it since we made it.
We have not gotten any emails.
According to Lucas, probably covering his ass for not checking either.
Respond.
Just don't look at the inbox.
But yeah, I mean, I think this will be kind of a nice closure for our pilot season, just because we do kind of even go back to the whole simulacra idea. We're just forcing people to listen to all 1 hour and 40 minutes of that. But yeah, I just think it'll be kind of a nice close to our season, and well, pilot season, and then just, you know, hope you enjoy and expect great things to come.
Yeah, we're gonna work on production stuff, more content stuff, try to, you know, workflow on our end too. So we have plans. We're excited to do it. I hope you guys can understand the whole summer break thing. We'll be doing a lot of work then. But regardless, once again, our fifth and final episode of our pilot season, globalization. We hope you enjoy. And yeah, here we go. Lucas, cue music. Boop. That's not a song.
Oh, I actually have. Oh shit. Okay. Boop doop 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 boop boop
boop.
So there are lots of Starbucks everywhere.
Yeah.
Do you remember when there used to not be so goddamn many?
Yeah. I remember when, maybe not the exact first one that came in our neighborhood, but I remember when they started popping up, the hype was starting to build, people were excited.
Yeah. White women were excited. Specifically.
White women. Well, there are people too.
You fucking don't put that in my mouth.
Sorry. I didn't. It was reactionary. I know you weren't dehumanizing anyone. I know you weren't.
My God. All right. I'm going to start
over.
Yeah,
we're going to start over.
No, we'll keep it just so we all know how much of an asshole you are. It's fine. No, I think that Starbucks is like, once you get a Starbucks in your neighborhood, that's like the, because I really feel like we're in a simulation where they're just like
milestone Starbucks, markers.
Yep. And a Starbucks is like, you beat the game. You have successfully gentrified this neighborhood.
I think Starbucks, and then like a tier 2 gentrification is Whole Foods, at least in America. At least in America, if you have a Whole Foods in your neighborhood. South Park did a whole, didn't they do a whole season? I know they did a whole arc about it.
Probably. And I never watched it.
But. And I watched bits and pieces and I've heard conversations about it. But yeah, they're everywhere. It's like a milestone marker to have those multinational brands come into your town and set up shop.
Yeah, so that's like kind of how you know that now to have any fun in your neighborhood, you actually need money.
But then when you have money, it doesn't necessarily become fun. It just becomes recognizable.
I don't know.
Because having a Starbucks in your town, sure, is fun. But there's always going to be a consequence to it. What does having a Starbucks in your town do? It kicks out mom and pop coffee shop. It runs down because it already has. I'm going to use an example of a coffee shop. I'm going to call it Greenwood Coffee House. It's like it's named closely to a coffee shop from my hometown. And a block and a half away, there's a Starbucks. And the reason why the Greenwood Coffee House stood up for so long was because they're very famous and they focused on cold brews. That was the one type of coffee they focused on. They couldn't compete with Starbucks in the extravagant latte department and this 4 or 5 different coffee bean seeds from around the world that they could always have on stock. So they focused on their one thing and they were able to manage. There was another coffee house in the central area. And it was the Greenwood Coffee House and this other coffee house that were fighting it out. Starbucks came and one of the coffee houses went away. They just couldn't compete. They didn't have that specialized niche. And so like, yeah, it's fun bringing Starbucks in. It's fun having a Wendy's in, but there is a loss. There is that consequence. I don't want to say it's like a seesaw where it has to be perfectly balanced, but there something goes away.
Yeah, the reality is that while places like Starbucks and Whole Foods and like McDonald's might be great. Fuck you. I deserve it. Oh my god. I deserve it. I really did. I thought I got
winner.
You
winner. For the record, while I was monologuing, Lucas lowered his camera and used his microphone in a very phallic way. So in response, as Lucas started talking, which to Lucas's defense, I should have let him say it a few more sentences before I did anything. But what I did was essentially almost give fellatio to the mic stand.
Yeah, it was just
and that broke Lucas. Just a tip. And that was enough for Lucas. That was enough for Lucas.
Because I wasn't looking at you the whole time. I just looked down for like 2 seconds and you're like about to deep throat your mic. Anyway, what I was trying to say is that like these, like while a Starbucks might be really great, the effect that we see all across the world is that we end up seeing less unique stores. Everything kind of looks the same. And so an experience I had recently is that my wife and I drove to the Badlands, which is from where we are about a 7-hour drive through a lot of nothing. Like it was actually unsettling how much nothing we drove through. Not to be insulting.
Is it like flatland nothing or like eerie nothing?
Like flatland nothing. Like,
okay.
Like there's maybe a tree and I'm like trying to figure out how the fuck that tree got there.
Yeah. Don't forget, most of our listeners or a good chunk of our listeners are non-American, so they might not know what the Badlands are.
Yeah, so Badlands, they're just this, they were called the Badlands because they're so not conducive to farming because they're very mountainous and there's really no good way to farm. And so they were called the Badlands because they're bad for that. But they're also really beautiful. Just really wonderful formations. Also, apparently, so Amanda, as we're driving through, was just like, look, Lucas, it's so beautiful. Like, look at the pink band and all the mountains. And I'm just like, I don't see that color. So thanks. I am colorblind, by the way. So in case anyone was confused by that. So anyway, there were two things to do there. There was looking at the Badlands, and there was going to this place called Waldrug. Now, Waldrug was being advertised for hundreds of miles before we got there. So since there was nothing else to do, we're like, okay, we'll go to Waldrug because apparently this place is popping. And it was literally just like, it's not like there were chain stores there, but nothing that I couldn't get anywhere else. It was like an outdoor shopping mall. And it just had some trinkets. You know, they sold things that gave off the vibe of the area, like cowboy boots. And I just really got the sense that, like, who the fuck would drive 7 hours to experience something that you could experience where you drove from? Not the Badlands. Like, the Badlands were wonderful.
Yeah.
It's just the like, every place needs to have, like, a shopping experience. And that shopping experience is getting more and more the same anywhere you go.
Yeah.
It's like, what's the point?
This is, well, obviously and easily, unfortunately, is going to be a conversation about capitalism. Companies want to make money. What's the best way to make money? To reach as many people as possible. I think to go along what you were just saying, when our friends and I went to Tennessee for a week a couple summers ago, we were by Dollywood, by the Smoky Mountains, and we went to this outdoor shop with trinkets and whatnot. And there was this local, what are they called again? Not breweries. What's a place where you create whiskey? What is that place called? A vineyard is for wine. A brewery is for beer.
Distillery?
A distillery. Malt is liquor. Hard liquor. Whiskey. Yes. I believe so. And so we went to it, and they were and they had, like, history in the moonshine, and they were, like, reflecting a lot. And, like, when we were there, we thought that, you know, I was under the impression that this was really the only place that I could get this Tennessee whiskey, this Tennessee moonshine, so to speak. And they had different flavors. They had all sorts of these really eclectic assortments of hard liquor. You know, we spend a good amount of money wanting to support the local business there, buying things that we can only get there and drinking things that we can only get there. Couple months later, I go to Kansas City, Missouri, where my brother and my father are. I go to a supermarket, go to the liquor section, and they're all there. They're all there. And not, you know, we didn't go there because we knew this was the only place to get this kind of liquor. We didn't buy, you know, but we did buy the liquor because we genuinely believed this was the only place we could get to get it. We were able to get it. And I'm not blaming, like, I'm not trying to pin false advertisement. I'm not trying to blame misleading. It's just, now, if we want to get that beverage again, we don't have to go to Tennessee. And maybe perhaps that was the intent for the people who came and visited. If you want the drink here, you could get it from your place. But the more that happens, and with the more things that happen, it becomes less about, let's go experience Tennessee. So if we were to put this a bit more globally and not so much to Americans traveling across America or within America, but someone from Europe goes to America and they're like, I want to experience American South. They could pick any southern state and go wherever, whether they have a good time or not, we won't know. But that's really the case. That's rarely the case. Or if they really want to, they'll go to Texas, or they'll go to Memphis. They'll go to a big city. not really feel it, but they would only have to go to one of them. But then they wouldn't really have to go to one of them. They would just have to go to an American metropolis, get an American experience, be overwhelmed by the American experience, and be like, all right, well, that was America. Bye-bye. And then they realized, well, why did I go to America to do this? If I'm just going to look at skyscrapers, tall buildings, I could do that there. I came here for like a novelty experience. So I think we're starting where we might get to a point where we're where going places is a novelty and less a holistic experience by traveling someplace. Yeah, especially if we're talking about like tangible things. If we're talking about things that we want to get and objects, there's no reason, or there's going to be no reason, to go to a specific country.
I think that what I'm noticing is that the array of experiences that we have when we travel to a place, they become very similar experiences. I am a very exploratory person. I love to explore places. And the thing that just makes me kind of disappointed about travel nowadays is that wherever you go, like, globalization has even affected the experiences that you can have at that place. Because basically you travel somewhere and your experiences are limited to shopping, and you get to shop for items that have the vibe of the place that you are experiencing. But it's just weird to me, because you are buying an object that has the vibe of the place you have went to, but you didn't experience the vibe that you actually tried to purchase. Is that making any sense? This is going back to the whole simulacra thing.
I was just, like, why buy? For some reason, I'm like thinking about like Tokyo, right? Like, let's say I go to like Shinjuku or somewhere in Tokyo or in Japan, and I buy a little thing that says Tokyo, Japan, instead of buying something from Tokyo, Japan. Like, it, yes, I get where you're coming from. I think it is a bit hard to say in words, but I what a cliche statement to say there's layers to this, right? But not only is the commercial aspect due to globalization becoming very similar to where, based off where we live, especially in urban areas and developed nations, we are seeing just copy and pasting here and there, with regional differences. And then we're getting to the place where, when places become well known or known enough, that they start to cater to the demographics that they're getting an influx. And then once they have that established, they'll start to cater towards other growing markets that are coming into their town. So you have tour guides, you have vacation packages, and experiences are becoming bundled together, where as an individual, I get to pick and choose from a lot of these things, but in a macroscopic lens, the general mass of people are only allowed to choose out of these 10 set experiences that are borderline very controlled for the sake of the experience. You want the best, you want to give the customer the best experience, you want to give the customer the most curated experience. You're gonna have that kind of shit in lockdown, you're gonna have that tight. And there's very few parts where you could kind of stray away. That's why cruise ships are so well regulated and well regimented in terms of schedules and what you can do. And what we're very much risking and losing as a result is, I think, a natural experience. And it is hard. It is hard to go to a new place that one is unfamiliar with and trying to garner experiences. You need some kind of direction to go to. You need some kind of a notice that says, hey, this is what's been done, you could try it out. But when cities are like, come try paragliding here, come try doing this, look at our super tall building in this town, look at this water ferry that you could go in this city, look at this select dolphin that you can see if you go on this boat ride. I mean, am I talking about New York, LA, Amsterdam? Am I talking about Tokyo or London? Like, these unique experiences stop becoming unique and become niche they become, as we were saying. And I think the whole tourist branded thing has the psychological effect of what people want to partake in. And we are seeing people try to find unique experiences, but they are very quickly, once a new experience is found, it gets commercialized heavily quick or very quickly, and then relied on heavily or copy pasted elsewhere in the world.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, like, I mean, another thing just to add to this is also resorts, because resorts are a great example of, there's one system that works. It's not like you go to a different country and they have a different kind of system. That's all the same, right? You go to DR, a resort in DR, you know, you go to like Punta Cana or something, and you could be in Jamaica, you could be in New Zealand. It doesn't matter. It's the same shit, right? So in my mind, you just travel to that place, not to explore and experience that place, but for an experience that you're very accustomed to. And the only thing that's different from like Dominican Republic and like if I were to go there, like from Minnesota, is that the climate's completely different. So I spent all that money just so I can experience a different climate, but nothing else really. And so that ends up being another cookie cutter experience. I think that basically when we're talking about globalization, we can't talk about globalization without talking about cookie cutter experiences.
Yeah, the fit the mold. It what works works. Do we say if it's not broken, don't fix it kind of mentality? There is bits and pieces of innovation, but those innovations are usually towards keeping people within the property, trying to get the people who are in the property to spend more money. And how do we make it so that it becomes illusions of choices? It becomes, well, you could do this or this for the price of this, but it doesn't matter because no matter what, they're getting your money.
Yeah. And that's the other thing too, is that I don't really think we understand how to exist without just, I mean, like every experience we have is commodified. And so like, I think for me, I really draw on my experiences as much as I can, because since I am Maltese, and I remember a time in Malta where you could actually, you know, have fun without the whole commodify. And I still do, like, I do the same thing when I go that I would have done back in the day, right? But like, let me just explain what I mean, okay? Because I think that Malta has become incredibly commodified because of, you know, tourism accounts for 95% of our GDP. So that would make sense. But like, that's when dangerous. It is. I mean, I think that Maltese people actually have an existential problem that is not spoken about nearly enough. And this is with any country that derives most of their income from tourism. They mm-hmm. all have an existential issue, which is that in order to sustain themselves, they basically have to sell them, like they have to sell their culture, and they lose a sense of their identity, because it's okay, this is kind of going back to the whole simulacra thing again, but by the way, for anyone that doesn't want to listen to episode 2, simulacra is essentially the idea that we don't understand the difference between simulation and reality. And so,
ooh, mysterious topic. Sounds cool. Sounds like, yeah, it's worth a listen. Ooh.
You should listen to it. All 1 hour, 40 minutes of it.
Yeah, it was the most, yeah. And we still didn't talk about everything we wanted to.
I know. It's just a really big topic. Yeah. But anyway, the point is that you can't differentiate between simulation and reality. And I'm not sure if this is the right term for what I'm talking about, but I know that with cultures like Maltese culture that relies so much on tourism, I don't think we really experience ourselves anymore, because we're so conscious of like trying to define ourselves so that we can make money, because we can't make money without being like come get the Maltese experience. Like, this is what Malta is. And so then people come for our culture that we've now commodified, and we don't even know who the fuck we are anymore. I don't know if that is making any sense, but it is in my head. So back to the experiences that I had as a child versus the experiences that I see tourists having. When I was a kid, most of my time was spent with family, which is, of course, right, because I'm visiting family. And for the record, I was not born and raised in Malta. I just visited there. I was lucky enough to visit quite frequently, like enough to actually consider myself part of their culture.
Beautiful.
And so we would, you know, I'd be with family most of the time. And my idea of a good time is just like finding like cousins that I'm close with and just like going to this beach. My grandmother's beach, well, not my grandmother's beach, she doesn't own the beach. The beach in my grandmother's village is named Hunda. And my favorite thing to do there is just like to go with my cousins and just like, you know, just have fun with them, like just make experiences with them, or just go explore with them, you know. The beach is free. Everything I would do aside from getting food was free. And that's my idea of a good time. Now, what I have seen happen is that tourists come to Malta wanting like the Maltese experience, right? And we've had to like commodify ourselves so much that I see they have these giant speedboats. They're like a tour boat or something that they just blast music. Mm-hmm. And the whole grab of these boats is that they drive you into caves, blast music, which can't be good for your ears, but whatever. And like they have a type of engine that actually allows them to do a 360 on the spot. So they like go in a cave, blast music, and spin you around. And I'm just like, how are you experiencing Malta right now? You're just ruining it for everybody else, you know, everyone that doesn't want to hear your shitty music. But I don't know how connected this is to globalization. I'm just kind of lamenting at this point, maybe.
I mean, I'm pretty sure it does have a significant attachment to globalization and the effects of what a world audience has done to Malta.
Yeah. Well, the sad thing is we wouldn't be able to survive without that.
Yeah. I think another country, maybe not similar, but went through something like that, was Singapore. They developed very quickly post-World War II. And they have very strict laws, coming from even an American standard, we would consider conservative. And yet they flourished, and yet they had to sell a lot of, I guess, commodify a lot of their Singaporean culture. And also being a tax haven helped. And that's another way in which I think globalization does have effects on certain nations. Like Ireland is a tax haven, and that's done a toll on their local economy. And you've had, you know, you had big corporations like Apple. They'd have a subsidiary filed in Ireland to go through tax loops that EU kind of came into. They got into scrutiny with the EU, was told to pay a fine. It was nothing, paltry. Not even a drop in a bucket, a drop in, I don't know, the condensation of a bottle's worth of a fine that Apple had to pay.
Yeah, I mean, they're not, the fines that they make them pay end up being cost of business fines.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is that if you know that all you're going to get, like you're going to make so much more profit by doing that, and the fine that you have to pay essentially is just like a necessary thing to do in order to make that profit, they're going to do it. they know damn well that fine's coming, and they don't care because that fine is meaningless to them. It's actually, no, maybe it's not meaningless. It's actually quite meaningful to them. It's like the thing that they need.
For them, they see it as a tax.
Yeah.
It's like, just a lot of tickets that, I forgot who made that argument. Almost any kind of ticket that requires some kind of financial debt, like a fine, is a rich man tax, is a poor man's law. Like a speeding ticket is a poor man's law. A rich person can rip through 90 in their BMW, Porsche, or whatever, over 40, pay a fine and keep doing it. Of course, you know, over exaggeration, but that's what it becomes. I mean,
well, it's a parking violation. I don't think you have a limit on those, because I think you would have a limit on speeding.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, because you do get points. Parking violations, yeah, I think is a better example. You just pay the fine.
Yeah.
And I got parking tickets when I lived in New York. And there were days that I either missed it by a few minutes or days that I genuinely forgot. And like that shit hurts.
Yeah.
You know, you have to pay $130 per ticket. Yeah. It's so costly.
Over here, I think it's $17.
Really?
Yeah. And then so I did the math when I went to the U over here. Like, because, you know, I have to pay like $3-4 for parking for like a class, you know, and I would just do the math like, wait a minute, based on how much they actually check, it actually saves me money to just risk it, you know, because they didn't really check that much. So I'm like, if I just don't pay and risk it, I'm actually spending less money. So I parked illegally all the time. As long as there was no risk of me getting towed, it was worth it.
Yeah, and it doesn't, like, that didn't deflect you, that didn't deter you away from continuing what you were doing, because it was beneficial to you.
Yeah, because ultimately I'm making more money, which goes back to your point
of scale it up.
Yeah, like if they made the cost something that could actually hurt me, then I was going to be paying for parking.
Mm-hmm. Or you would have found another place to park.
Yeah.
And that's what countries get, I think, smaller countries and developing countries get stuck on and get scared of is, and as you were saying, they are reliant on a world audience. They are reliant on tourism. And so for them to do any tangible, real change is going to affect their bottom line, is going to make them lose money. Initially, of course, any big change like that. But if it's for the sake of sustainability, if it's for the sake of trying to keep a culture as intact as it can possibly be, it probably won't ever be fully intact. Now the floodgates of globalization have opened in Malta, just using Malta for an example here, you know, insert anyone else's home country. I think this applies universally almost.
Yeah.
Yes, there are countries that are still developing that have not made it to the stage of probably relying on tourism and probably being able to attract people on a critical mass aspect. There are places that are still developing that are bringing in tourism that just aren't as well known. But regardless, considering those outliers, I think, I don't want to say like, the corporate overlords not only own people, but also own small countries. But
the thing about just using Malta as the example, it's not corporate overlords. It's just, I mean, that's us. Like, we're kind of doing it to ourselves in a way. So it's not even like these big corporations. The thing about Malta is that like now they have Starbucks and McDonald's, which was, they didn't have that before. And, you know, when you go to a place that was so secluded that actually like had their own, and they still do, like, but they had their own cuisine, you didn't even have the option of getting McDonald's. Like, you go to Malta, you're eating their food, that's it, right? And now you basically, like, you get to go and like still have your McDonald's. And it's like, you know, it just ends up being like you travel how many miles to just experience the same thing. Also, I just wanted to share an experience that connects back to something I said earlier. I think it'll make what I was saying earlier actually make sense now. So I have only ever been to the villages in Malta that my parents and grandparents are from. Those villages are pretty Maltese. Like, they're Maltese people that live there. Especially my grandmother's village, like, the food is very much just Maltese food. There's no McDonald's in that village, nothing. So I ended up for just a couple days before flight back to New York, I ended up going with Amanda to the village St. Paul. And I have never felt like such an outsider in my entire life being there, because I didn't even know that this existed. Just to give you a perspective, like, my grandmother's village, we had to stop walking one time. Like, my cousin and I were walking, and we just had to stop walking because a shepherd was crossing with all his sheep. Okay, like, that's the kind of village we're talking about. And so we go to St. Paul, and there are lights. There's, like, restaurants advertising authentic Maltese food. I ate at one of them. It didn't taste anything like Maltese food. Some of them didn't even advertise that they were selling Maltese food. They were just, like, very brazen about the fact that, I mean, it was good food, but it was just, like, generic European food, you know? And, like, no one was speaking Maltese. I just was so confused. Like, I was just genuinely confused. And they're selling things like kind of like Maltese trinkets, like that, like, yeah, I've been to Malta because I shopped at this store and bought this thing. And I just have never felt like so, like, such an outsider.
In your home country.
Yeah. Because it was, there was nothing Maltese about it. But apparently it's also like a huge tourist spot. Like, tourists will go there to experience Malta. And I'm like, you're not experiencing a damn thing that's Maltese over here. It was like, it honestly reminded me of, have you ever been to Downtown Disney? Okay, well, no. I don't think it's called Downtown Disney anymore. But it's just, it was just like going to, it's like Disney World, like, it's next to Disneyland or Disney World, whatever. But it's just, it's like a strip with a lot of stores and experiences that you can buy. It just reminded me of that. It was like I could have just been in Florida instead of Malta, and also felt less shitty because, yeah. Oh, and there were, like, more inland, there were these big apartment complexes. That's where the Maltese people were. They were in these, like, kind of just shitty apartments.
Like, urban hellscape kind of.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I'm not diluting, discrediting, not trying to put what you're experiencing a peg down in any which way. So please don't take it that way. But you do have the cultural know-how, and you do have the familial connection, and you do have the connection which tourists don't. And I think a counter to the kind of conversations we're having is, can be that, well, Lucas, you know Malta so well because you've been there so often and you're privileged enough to be able to go there and you have family there and you visit people there. What about me, who's never been to Malta and who doesn't know you, when I go to Malta and all I have is TripAdvisor and hotels.com telling me what I should do and where I should go? What can I do? Like, how am I supposed to experience true Malta if true Malta isn't going to advertise itself? How is anyone going to be able to experience a true place when that true place, an authentic place, isn't going to advertise itself? Maybe whether they are, maybe they don't, because they actually don't want that globalization. Like, they they realize and they saw what a world audience does and they're closing themselves off so they don't want to advertise, or they just are so ingrained in the history of that nation, of that culture, that there really isn't a proper way for them to advertise, or the people who have run it are old school, quote unquote, that they don't rely on technology in the way that would be able to help them and that would evidently help them survive in a globalized world. But then do we want that? Because it, you know, the cyclical questions of is globalization good or bad come back to haunt us when we bring about another aspect of a culture opening up to the world.
Yeah, I mean, that's always going to be the point, right? It's not because, of course, globalization isn't all bad. It has allowed Malta to survive. I mean, my dad grew up like so dirt poor. He had his Christmas present every single year was the same fire truck that he was allowed to play with for one day. And his mom would just put it away for the rest of the year. Like, you know, there have been benefits to it. And I mean, and for the people wanting to experience it, you know, the more globalized the world is and the more they advertise themselves, the more people actually get to experience it. So it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about the negative side of that double-edged sword, because that's just the side I experience. Because, like, honestly, without all that globalization stuff that has made Malta very open to the world, I would have a better experience of Malta personally, because I know the things over there. Someone like you wouldn't know what to do, I guess. So, and you don't have family there to visit, because, like, a lot of my experiences just come from, like, being with family.
So, and actually the same for me in my home country, in my father's hometown. I would know what to do. I would know where to go. It's been 15 years, but I could go back and shit's changed, sure. But I know the area. If you were to go there, you have no idea what to do. You just go to the big metro city and do touristy things. And like, are you truly experiencing? I guess I'll say it. Do people know, one, what race I am, what ethnicity I am? And
Well, you could just say it now. You're Black.
Yeah, okay. So, in Black Asia, ethnically, I am Japanese. Nationality, I am American. So, both of my parents are from Japan, met in America. Complicated history. But I go back to my father's hometown in the countryside of Japan.
Wait, sorry to cut you off, but
yeah,
that's very similar to my parents, except that my mom was born in New York and my dad was born in Malta. But like, basically they met in New York.
My mother was born in Nagoya on the western side of Japan. My father was born in the Miyagi-ken, or the Miyagi prefecture, which was on the east side, and his hometown was the town directly in direct line with the 2011 tsunami.
That was the town that got hit first?
Yeah. I don't know if it's first, but it was like right there. Like, okay. It probably was like number two or number one, but it was one of the most heavily damaged areas.
Tsunamis scare the crap out of me.
Yeah, they are. The tsunami prep is crazy. The water, like, residing isn't the right word. Water, like, going in to the ocean. Yes, thank you. Receding, that tsunami in that ocean, collecting all that mass and all that energy. And then it just, because it doesn't look, when it's coming towards you, it doesn't look devastating, unless it's a truly devastating tsunami, because we imagine to see like 100-foot tall wall of water, but it's not. It's just an onslaught, a non-stop rush of it.
Yeah.
But then you get anything above a magnitude 7 on the Richter scale, you do get dangerous looking things.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to stall your story here, but the thing that actually made me really just realize how terrifying tsunamis are is I was on some kind of log flume ride, and there was, so I wasn't on the ride, there was a bridge that basically it was placed in such a way that when the log flumes would go down, it would spray you.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, I was on the bridge, one of them came down extra hot. And I think it could have broken my back.
Mm-hmm.
It hit me so hard that without me realizing it, I went from holding the rails looking down to my back hitting the other rail on the other side and almost falling over into the water. And I was in an immense amount of pain because that went right between two vertebrae of mine. And I was like, wow, so if that messed me up this badly, imagine a tsunami.
Yeah. I thought the way you were speaking, I thought you experienced a tsunami as well.
No, it's just that my little log flume experience
would be like, oh my goodness, what if we scaled this up?
Yeah. So anyway, sorry to derail you there.
Oh no, it's okay. It's what else is new, right? But if you were to go to the countryside of Japan, or if you go to Japan, how would you experience Japan? Would you know what to do in Japan? Would you go to Tokyo? Would you go to Kyoto? You probably go to Hokkaido, the northern islands, and you experience Japan. You would experience Japan. But the Japan I would experience going, if I were to go in the countryside, is an absolutely completely different side of Japan, where there's only people that look Japanese, where they speak Japanese, and it that is experiencing Japan, because that is Japan. That isn't it is technically a Japan that one can peer into, but it is a Japan that is not intended for a global audience.
Because I wouldn't even be able to speak to the people, right? Because mm-hmm. I'm assuming they don't speak English.
Yeah, they wouldn't speak English. The only way to get there is by car or by train. And it's not even by bullet train. You have to go to the main prefecture station and go on a little train from that the main station and go to that countryside town. And Japan, though not big, larger than Malta, it has that space relative to Malta to kind of seclude parts of itself, if it, you know, as if it wants to, like it's a sentient thing. But there is some semblance of a hive mind sentience in a country and a culture, I believe, that wants to partake in a larger arena. Another wants to be left alone.
Well, I think that's how you end up with, in all of these countries that I know of that have a very similar, the way you just described Japan, very similar to how I described Malta.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of those countries end up dealing with their own wave of authoritarianism, or, you know, just far right extremism, because you have, for example, Maltese politics are, you have labor and nationalist parties. Nationalist is basically the equivalent of conservative in the United States, and labor would be the equivalent of Democrat or, you know, liberal in the United States. But it's not a great translation, because basically I don't identify with either party.
Mm-hmm.
And not that I identify with either party within the US, but
yeah,
I really don't identify with either party. I definitely identify with one party more in the US than the other. And I think recently that would be the same in Malta, just because the Nationalist Party has kind of gone off the deep end.
How extreme one is. Yeah.
but as far as when you think about what the parties used to value, right? The Labour Party was, and still is, way more in favor of globalization. They want to propel Malta onto the world stage, and that, to me, I'm actually not really all for. And by the way, I'm speaking from being Maltese American, where I don't have to deal with what happens if we aren't propelled onto the world stage. So I get that, but I'm just saying that they don't really think too much about you know, the culture that exists in Malta. On the other hand, nationalists, way more concerned about cultural issues. But once again, they have kind of gone way off the deep end lately, because it's, you know, now that Malta is becoming more globalized, they're becoming more extreme in like preserving what they think our culture is.
Yeah. I think because it's hard to contextualize another country's politics within the lens of American politics, because one, we have a broken partisan party or partisan bipartisan system, and they're very specific. Democrats and Republicans are kind of placeholder words for another time, I guess. But yeah, as more, since there's no, I don't want to go too off, but I'll have this be my last thought before we go into closing thoughts. And this will translate to other conversations that we will have in the future. But you have one end of a country, of a culture trying to progress. And right now that progression means globalization. And then we have another, the opposite end of this culture or society that doesn't want to propel forward, that wants this train of culture to stay still and to not move. And the more we try, or the more the culture and society try to propel forward, the more and the harder the people who want to stay still will try to sabotage the train moving forward. And no one in the middle, the passengers, the regular, perhaps a conductor, the people that are just going for the ride, who don't really mind going forward, just maybe not as fast and as aggressive as we're going forward. We don't mind going forward, though. It's helped. You know, we're not back there anymore, but we're progressing. We also don't want to have a full stop, but we also agree, let's not go fully over there. And because the vocal minority is the opposite ends of the people who are trying to push forward and the people who are trying to stop, since they're the most vocal, the majority, we're not saying as much, we're not getting our voices heard as much. One, because there wasn't a need not to, and there's a lot of socio-cultural, political, economical things. It's a whole hodgepodge soup as to why we aren't doing what we're doing another time again. And we're getting to this point where it's so stretched, the two sides are so stretched and far apart, when one of them, and eventually one of them has to give up, one of them has to let go. It can't be in perpetuity, an immovable object, an unstoppable force. Something has to give. That is a figurative speech. That's not going to last forever in a society and a culture. So when one of these things let goes, if it's the back that's trying to hold the train down that goes, we're just going to propel straight into a godforsaken unforeseen future. And the people propelling stop propelling, we're just going to stop and crash and tumble, and then eventually slow down to dead nothing. And I think, where are we, as at least within our country in America? God knows, I don't even know how many rails. I think we're like multi-track drifting in America. I don't even know if we're on the right track. I think we're like next to the train tracks. We're just not driving on the train tracks. We're just saying.
We have so many like microcosms within the United States that, I mean, you can go to a small town from a big city and experience people that honestly you can't understand their way of thinking, because they just think nothing like you, and vice versa. A lot of people cannot understand, like, we have people that really are not guided by religion whatsoever in the same country as people that think everything must be guided by religion. And like, people who think in terms of religion, I realized, are like, it's very difficult for someone who thinks about everything in terms of religion to have a conversation with someone who does not think in terms of religion whatsoever, because they're just coming from two completely different places. my point is, this is why we're having the conversations we're having in the United States right now, because it's like all over the place.
Yeah. And we're telling everyone that you're right.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, as far as the, I'm not sure if I cut you off there, if you wanted to say something else, but
if anything, I was going to go into closing statements and closing ideas.
Okay.
So, but that was just me. So if you want to say anything else, by all means, go for it.
No, I was just going to say that I think that ultimately globalization is a double-edged sword. And I think that this is nothing new. Like, the fact that I'm saying this is nothing new. People have known this for a while. But the issue I see with it is that it's a double-edged sword that we can't do anything about. Because a Starbucks can outcompete any mom and pop coffee shop they want to, because they can afford to lose business for a while by lowering their prices until they kill their competition. And so basically the problem I see with it is that it's inevitable, and the people who are being hurt by it really don't have a voice. And it's also limiting the kinds of experiences that we can have, because I think this is a George Carlin quote, and he was talking about the United States here, but he was basically saying, like, look what we've done to this beautiful land. Like, we've turned it into a giant shopping mall, talking about the US. Yeah. But I actually think that's what we're doing to the entire world now. It's just a giant shopping mall. And the thing about shopping malls is you go into a mall and there shouldn't be any one store that surprises you. That's kind of the point of a mall. You know the stores that are in the mall before you even walk in.
Yeah.
And you know, so like now when you go to a more secluded place like Malta, or I don't know if I can call Japan a more secluded place, but would you call it that?
I mean, what's, I no, I can't consider Japan a secluded place, no.
I mean, okay, just a different place than the one you're in right now.
Mm-hmm.
You go to Japan and it's like, you know, they've got McDonald's and Starbucks, and sorry to be shitting on those two stores, but there are plenty of
how
others.
Dare you, I'm a McDonald's stan.
Their fries are amazing.
Lucas, shut up, they're not gonna bring back the chicken wraps if you keep talking shit about them.
Alan's actually having a breakdown. but no, it's like just the place I'm coming from is that it would be one thing if globalization was kind of a push that there were more voices involved in, but the only voices that really matter are corporate voices.
Yes.
And so it doesn't, like, how globalized is that?
Yeah.
Where not everyone's voice even counts. And we can't do anything about it. And you can, like, yeah, there are benefits of having a McDonald's in Malta, but we didn't get to choose, you know. Actually, Maltese politics are very corrupt. Politicians got to choose that one.
Yeah. So, like, there's no, like, European coalition of mom-pa coffee shops.
Yeah.
And there's no way for, because the point of local business is to be not centralized, is to not be connected. And the moment we connect, it becomes a network, becomes a national, international network. You lose a little bit of the mom and pop-ness. But I guess that's where globalization comes in, or the talks of globalization comes in, is that if we are going to expand our world, if we are going to connect it and make it smaller, we ought to make it so that the voices that are now ever closer have a proper say. And then this becomes into the talks of freedom again, like the of like, well, we want our voices heard. And I'm not putting light into it, though that was very much the tone in which that I said it. The problem, the hiccup here is that, like what Lucas just said, is that the voices that are the globalization ought to have been able to propel, that ought to have been able to make louder, were not the voices of the shops that would gain more customers, would gain more notoriety from exposure to the world, but it's already these companies that are pushing essentially the world. Like, the world isn't the world. The world is when the world comes to your, to one's country, it's not, you know, really the world that's coming to one's country. It is Starbucks. It is McDonald's, again, shooting in those countries. If we want to talk about manufacturing, it is something like Foxconn. It is something like TSMC. It is, the world is, I don't want to say corporate overlords, but a lot of these corporations, multinationals, are now the face of the world, or the face of humanity is Coca-Cola, is the corporation, Hill Corporate. They go to yours, they recognize your city, your state, your region, your country as a profitable means. They're going to profit off of you.
And they're like going sponsor to push something.
It. Yeah, and they're going to try to do all this local stuff and be like, look at us sponsoring the local children. Come join these kids here as we support and create a better and brighter future for them, and help us achieve this goal. Come visit us here, and we are proud to announce to open our this place. This is very first Whole Foods. Congratulations to them. When in, like, but I don't know if what I'm angry about or if what upsets me is the lack of choices or the meddling and the fusion of experiences to the point where it becomes so mundane, where it becomes so recognizable, where it doesn't matter who you are, where you're at, you could experience the world. And then this becomes like, the what's the point of living in a fucking reality? And then we're going to go into Simulacra again. Then we're going to go into a conversation about Matrix. But I'm going to stop us there. I'm going to stop myself there. But like, it becomes like, okay, here were the words that I was going to say. Like, a corporation is going to see a place and say, you are now profitable. We have now deemed you a place that is now profitable. So we're going to make money off of you. I think, like, the idea, just how Pride Month become commercialized, it's fucking disgusting.
All of a sudden, like, all these corporations are woke. It's like, no, you just realize it's profitable.
No.
When it was profitable for you to be fucked up, that's what you were.
That's what you were. And then I saw goddamn fucking Juneteenth, like, party bags or like party decorations. And what the fuck, man?
You know, I think to celebrate, because like Target, right? They want to be all woke and shit now.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the way that I'll believe them when they allow a queer person to just fucking throw a brick through their windows and not arrest them. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you profiting off of it isn't making a statement. Jesus Christ, do you think people aren't going to shop at Target now because that's what they've done? That, okay, yeah. Here's the thing. Mm-hmm. They don't have anywhere else to shop. If all the places to shop are selling Pride shit, then what are people going to do? Not buy things they need? They'll be mad about it. They'll rant about it on Facebook.
And it cannot be out of here. I don't think I can believe a statement that says that Target or any multinational, out of the fear of losing customers, or out of the fear of saying something not so great to a undermined community or group of people, we are going to support this said group of people. Absolutely not. No, it's not out of fear of losing customers. It's just more money. Like, they, especially if we're talking about loss leaders, that's something that they're going to try out in a pretty progressive location of a store. If it does well, they'll do it nationwide. That's probably what they did. And that's what they do. And the irony isn't lost on anyone, especially for like a Juneteenth party decoration. Something was built in Taiwan in sweatshop conditions for being paid, people being paid cents a day, and then upmarked 400% to be sold to people who are probably in an underprivileged situation. Like, what? That.
Yeah, like,
all I can say is what? What?
There was, I remember last year, it's probably also out this year, but the most disgusting thing I saw as far as corporate lingo, if you want to call it that, is concerned. I saw some Skittles and they were all white. And the on the bag said, the only rainbow that matters like during June is the pride rainbow or something like that, right? And I wanted to hurl, like it, I wanted to open the bag of Skittles and hurl inside of it. Just because first, okay, let me just explain why. I'm going to do my best to explain to our apparently one loyal listener why I'm so upset by this. They're not, it's not like they're not making money, right? Now they might even be making more money.
Yeah.
It's like a humble brag. They're humble, right? Because they're putting themselves, they're trying to like perform as being, you know, we don't care about ourselves. We care about the LGBTQ community.
Mm-hmm. But shop at our locations.
Yeah, but please still give us money though.
Yeah.
Because that, look, Skittles doesn't give a shit what color their Skittles are.
Mm-hmm.
They just care about the color green. Like,
that's they don't care about what color goes out. They care about the color that comes in.
Yep. That's it. And that was not a planned. That whole thing wasn't planned. I just realized that that is actually the color they care about.
Yeah.
So that's just why I was disgusted by it, because it's not like, I mean, that statement was only meant to make sure that everybody knows that they're on the woke train.
Mm-hmm.
So we still give them money. And by the way, I don't actually have a problem with, I mean, because woke has kind of become like an inside insult among mm-hmm. liberals and leftists to kind of, you know, put each other down for performing
mm-hmm.
over actually being. So I don't actually have a problem with people, you know, being respectful being. Of,
yeah.
Yeah, like being. It's just the performative nature of, mm-hmm. and I don't think, I mean, I know there are some good intentioned people in Skittles that really do care about pride, but the problem
I'm sure it started out as a pitch, and that was like, hey, like, I think we should really do this. I think it'd be great for our company. I think it's great for our image, but like, I really think we should support this. And then they'd be like, okay, the next question that was asked was, how much is it going to cost to put, to change the color purple into this?
Yeah. I mean, ultimately you've got people that really could not care less about political issues that their company supports or doesn't yeah. support, aside from Chick-fil-A. That's the one company that I will give credit to for really not caring about performing anything.
Oh yeah. Yo, fuck Chick-fil-A.
Yeah, I mean, Chick-fil-A sucks. I'm not saying I respect them as a company. I just at least respect them for not like,
oh yeah, yeah, for like like, at least if they're gonna be hateful, like, we know it. Like, they let us know.
Yeah,
like, them and not like, accept
Hobby Lobby.
Oh yeah, oh fucking yeah, Hobby Lobby.
Yeah, I hate that Hobby Lobby is so much better than Michael's.
What a court case that was.
Yeah.
So
you know what I think we should do?
What?
I think we've kind of made our points, and since in the spirit of globalization never ending,
mm-hmm.
we should actually end our first podcast with a period
instead of what were we using before? I think we just did a line break.
Yeah, we would just cut ourselves off.
Yeah.
And I mean, yeah, it would be nice to actually end one of these with just us saying something and finishing saying that thing.
Yeah, and like having a constructed sentence, like a little closing statement.
Yeah.
So what were you going to say?
Well, I was just going to say, thank you for listening to episode 5, our final episode of Distracted Propaganda. We've had a great time being your host for our pilot season. Once again, my name's Lucas.
I'm Alan.
And there are going to be great things coming next season, which we will call season one. But just to give you a little teaser, all these five episodes have been bullshit. From here on out, we are actually, now you know, next season, actually next episode of next season, Alan is going to attempt to stick 9-inch nails through each one of their eyelids, and I'm going to staple my nuts to a stack of papers. And a week after that, if we're still alive, we'll each drink a fifth of vodka and dare each other to drive.
I don't think we're going to make it.
We're going to do it. We got this.
I liked hens and cocks much better than this.
Oh, we're doing both.
Well, okay. Here we go.
If you ever come to our front office and ring the little bell and I don't come, that's because I have to get my nuts off of a stack of papers.
Mm-hmm. Or you guys just stand there and watch me burn.
Be like, do you have a staple remover?
I didn't get that. Well, it was a pretty shitty joke anyways. Anyways.
Yes. What does the future hold for us? We are... Yeah, I mean, honestly, who knows? But we do plan on having more episodes per season from here on out. We plan on using the summers to actually work on production and maybe even advertising a little bit. And then using the fall / winter months, maybe even early spring, to push out content. And we also might, you know, we might have some bonus episodes, some bloopers and things like that come out over the summer. So we won't be totally gone. We'll just be mostly gone.
Yeah, summer will definitely be our off seasons when we kind of cool it with the publishing, so we could focus on recording, production stuff, the back end stuff. We are excited. Lucas and I definitely want to commit to this a bit longer. We hope you guys stick with us. And hopefully this grows into something not too big, but decent enough and that's cool enough. So yeah.
Size doesn't matter.
Yeah. I think we should actually finally for once end an episode properly. So once again, my name is Lucas.
My name is Alan.
Thank you for listening to Destructive Propaganda. Tune in the fall and we'll see you soon. Thank you.
Do.
All right, I do gotta go.
Okay.
I'll call you back in a bit, okay?
Yep, sounds good. I'm gonna stop the recording.